Chapter 37. Before the match. Zivilcic's followers hold nighttime peace march. Article in the Swindon Daily Eye Strain, July 22, 1988. All 76 members of the Idolatry Friends of St. Zivilcic's spent the night silently marching between the places of interest of their worshipful leader, who was hit by a number 23 bus on Friday. The march began at Tesco's car park and visited places in Swindon that St. Zivilcic's held most dear. 7 pubs, 6 betting shops, and Swindon's leading brothel, before undertaking a silent prayer at his place of death. The march went off peacefully, except for numerous interruptions by a woman who gave her name as Shirley and insisted that Zivilcic's owed her money. I arrived at the croquet stadium at 8. The fans were already waiting at the turnstiles, hoping to get the best seats in the stands. I was waved past and parked my speedster in the manager's parking spot, then made my way into the changing rooms. Aubrey was waiting there for me, pacing up and down. "Well," he said, "where's our team?" "They'll be here at 1 o'clock." "Can't we get them here earlier?" he asked. "We need to discuss tactics." "No," I said firmly. "They'll be here on time. It's senseless to try to impose human time constraints on them. They're playing on our side. That's the main thing." "Okay," agreed Aubrey reluctantly. "Have you met Penelope Hurrah?" Penelope was a large and powerful woman who looked as though she could crack walnuts with her eyelids. She had moved to croquet because hockey wasn't violent enough, and although at 32 she was at the end of her career, she might prove an asset, as a terror weapon, if nothing else. She scared me, and I was on the same team. "Hello, Penelope," I said nervously. "I really appreciate you joining us."
"Ugh."
"Everything okay? Can I get you something?" She grunted again, and I rubbed my hands together anxiously. "Right, well, leave you to it then." I left her to talk strategy with Alf and Aubrey. I spent the next couple of hours doing interviews and ensuring that the team's lawyers were up to speed on the game's complex legal procedures. At midday, Landon and Friday arrived with Mycroft, Polly, and my mother. I took them down to the seating reserved for the VIPs, just behind the players' benches, and sat them down next to Joffy and Miles, who had arrived earlier.
"Is Swindon going to win?" asked Polly.
"I hope so," I said, not brimming with confidence.
"The problem with you, Thursday," put in Joffy, "is that you have no faith. We in the Idolatry Friends of St. Zivilcic's have complete faith in the revealments. Lose, and Goliath moves to new heights of human exploitation and unfathomable avarice, hidden amongst the trappings of religious formality and perverted ecclesiastical dogma."
That was a very good speech.
"Yes, I thought so too. I was practicing on the march last night. Don't feel you're under any pressure now."
"Thanks for nothing. Where's Hamlet?"
"He said he'd join us later."
I left them to do a live broadcast with Lydia Startright, who was really more interested in knowing where I had been for the past 2.5 years than asking me about Swindon's chances. After this, I hurried down to the players' entrance to welcome Stig, who was playing, and 4 other Neanderthals. They were completely unfazed by the media attention and ignored the phalanx of pressmen completely. I thanked them for joining our team, and Stig pointed out that they were there only because that was part of the deal, and nothing more. I walked them towards the changing rooms, where the human team members greeted them with a good measure of curiosity. They talked haltingly with one another, the Neanderthals confining their speech to the technical aspects of croquet play. It was of no matter or consequence to them if they won or lost. They would simply do the best they could. They refused body armor, as they preferred to play barefoot in shorts and brightly colored Hawaiian shirts. This caused a slight problem with the Toast marketing board, which had insisted that its name be on the team strip. But I smoothed it over with them eventually, and all was well. There was less than 10 minutes before we were due out, so Aubrey made a stirring speech to the team, which the Neanderthals didn't really comprehend. Stig, whose understanding of humans was perhaps a little better than most, just told them to
hoop as much as we can,
which they understood.
Miss Next.
I turned to face a thin, cadaverous man staring at me. I recognized him instantly. It was Ernst Strychnine, Kane's advisor, and he was carrying a red briefcase. I had seen a similar case at Goliathopolis, and during Evade the Question Time. It doubtless concealed an ovinator. What do you want?
Chancellor Kane would like to meet the Swindon team for a pep talk.
Why?
Strychnine looked at me coldly. It's not for you to question the will of the Chancellor, young lady.
It was then that Kane marched in, surrounded by his goons and entourage. The team stood up respectfully, except the Neanderthals, who, completely ambivalent to the vagaries of perceived hierarchy, carried on talking to one another in soft grunts. Kane looked at me triumphantly, but I noticed, too, that he had changed slightly. His eyes looked tired, and his mouth had a barely discernible sag to it. He'd started to show signs of being human. He was beginning to age.
Ah, he said, the ubiquitous Miss Next. Literatech, team manager, saviour of Jane Eyre. Is there anything you can't do?
I'm not that good at knitting. There was a ripple of laughter amongst the team, and also from Kane's followers, who abruptly silenced themselves as Kane glanced around the room scowling. But he controlled himself and gave a disingenuous smile after nodding to Strychnine.
I just came down here to talk to the team and tell all of you that it would be a far better thing for this country if I stayed in power. And even though I don't know how Zivilkix's revealment will work, I can't leave the secure future of this nation to the vagaries of a 13th century seer with poor personal hygiene. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I knew what he was up to. The Ovinator. It would, as likely as not, have us all eating out of his hand in under a minute. But I wasn't figuring on Hamlet, who appeared suddenly from behind Strychnine, rapier drawn. It was now or nothing, and I yelled, "The briefcase! Destroy the Ovinator!" Hamlet needed no second bidding, and he leapt into action, expertly piercing the case, which gave off a brief flash of green light and a short, high-pitched wail that started the police dogs outside barking. Hamlet was swiftly overpowered by two SO6 agents who handcuffed him.
"Who is this man?" demanded Kane. "He's my cousin Eddie." "No!" yelled Hamlet, standing up straight, even though he had two men holding him. "My name is Hamlet, Prince of Denmark, Danish and proud of it."
Kane gave a smug laugh.
"Captain, arrest Miss Next for harbouring a known Danish person, and arrest the entire team for aiding and abetting."
It was a bad moment. With no players, the game had to be forfeited. But Hamlet, actioneer that he had become, was not out of ideas.
"I shouldn't do that if I were you."
"And why not?" sneered Kane, not without a certain quaver in his voice. He was now acting solely on his wits. He had neither his fictional roots nor the Ovinator to help him.
"Because," announced Hamlet, "I am a very special friend of Miss Daphne Farquhar."
"And?" inquired Kane with a slight smile.
"She is outside, awaiting my return. If I fail to reappear, or you try any sort of anti-mallet skullduggery, she will mobilize her troops."
Kane laughed, and Strychnine, sycophant that he was, laughed with him.
"Troops? What troops are these?"
Kane asked, amused. But Hamlet was deadly serious. He glowered at them for a moment before answering.
"Her fan club. They're highly organized, armed to the teeth, profoundly angry at having their books burned, and ready to move at her command. There are 30,000 stationed near the stadium, and a further 90,000 in reserve. One word from Daphne, and you're finished."
"I have reversed the law banning Farquhar," replied Kane hastily, "and they will disperse when they learn this."
"They will believe nothing from your lying tongue," replied Hamlet softly. "Only that which Miss Farquhar tells them.
Your power is waning, my friend, and destiny's inelegant toe creaks the boards to your door.
There was a tense silence as Cain stared at Hamlet, and Hamlet stared back at Cain. I'd witnessed quite a few standoffs, but none with so much at stake.
You haven't a hope in hell anyway, announced Cain, after considering his options carefully. I'm going to enjoy watching the whackers thrash you. Release him.
The SO6 agents uncuffed Hamlet and escorted Cain out the door.
Well, said Hamlet, looks like we're back in the game. I'm going to watch with your mother. Win this one for the Farquhar fans, Thursday. And he was gone.
None of us had any time to ponder on the matter further, as we heard a klaxon go off and an excited roar from the crowd echoed down the tunnel.
Good luck, everyone, said Aubrey, with a good measure of bravado. It's showtime.
The crowd erupted into screams of jubilation as we trotted down the tunnel onto the green. The stadium could seat 30,000, and it was packed. Large monitors had been set up outside for the benefit of those who could not get a seat, and the TV networks were beaming the match live to an estimated 2 billion people in 73 countries worldwide. It was going to be quite a show. I stayed on the touchline as the Swindon Mallets lined up face to face with the Reading Whackers. They all glared at one another as the Swindon and District Wheel Tappers brass band marched on, headed by Lola Vavoom. There was then a pause while President Formby took his seat in the VIP box, and again, led by Ms. Vavoom, the audience stood to sing the unofficial English national anthem, When I'm Cleaning Windows. After the song had finished, Yorick Cain appeared at the VIP box, but his reception was derisory at best. There was a smattering of applause and a few hails, but nothing like the reception he was expecting. His anti-Danish stance had lost a lot of popular support when he'd made the mistake of accusing the Danish women's handball team of being spies and arresting them. I saw him sit down and scowl at the president, who smiled back warmly. I was standing at the touchline with Alf Widdershane, watching the proceedings.
"Is there anything more we could have done?" I whispered.
"No," said Alf after a pause. "I just hope those Neanderthals can cut the mustard."
I turned and walked back towards Landon. On his lap was Friday, gurgling and clapping his hands. I had taken him once to the chariot race in the novel of Ben-Hur, and he'd loved it.
"What are our chances, darling?" asked Landon.
"Reasonable to middling, with the Neanderthals playing. I'll speak to you later." I gave them a kiss each, and Landon wished me good luck.
"Dolor in reprehenderit, mummy," said Friday.
I thanked him for his kind words, and heard my name being called. It was Aubrey, who was talking to the umpire, who, as custom dictated, was dressed as a country parson.
"What do you mean?" I heard Aubrey say in an outraged tone as I moved closer.
It seemed there was some sort of altercation, and we hadn't even begun play yet.
"Show me where it says that in the rules."
"What's the problem?" I said.
"It's the Neanderthals," he said, between gritted teeth. "According to the rules, it seems that non-humans are barred from taking part."
I glanced back to where Stig and the four other Neanderthals were sitting in a circle, meditating.
Rule 7-8-B-4-5-2,
quoted the umpire, as O'Farthens, the Reading Whackers captain, looked on with a gleeful expression.
"No player or team may use an equine or any other non-human creature to gain an advantage over the opposing team."
"But that doesn't mean players," I said. "That rule clearly only refers to horse, antelope, and so forth. It was brought in when the Dorchester Slammers attempted to gain the advantage by playing on horseback in 1962.
"The rules seem clear to me," growled O'Farthens, taking a step forward. "Are Neanderthals human?"
Aubrey also took a step forward. Their noses were almost touching.
"Well, sort of," I answered, hesitantly.
There was nothing for it but to seek a judgment. Since the rules regarding on-field litigation had been relaxed 10 years ago, It was not uncommon for the first half hour of a match to be taken up with legal wranglings by the team's lawyers, of which each side was permitted two, with one substitute. It added a new form of drama to the proceedings, but it was not without its own problems. After a particularly litigious Super Hoop 6 years ago, when a legal argument was overturned in the High Court 2 years after the match was played, it became mandatory that three High Court judges be at readiness to give an instant, unquestionable ruling on any legal point. We approached the Porter Court, and our respective lawyers made their representations. The three judges retired to their chambers and returned a few minutes later to announce, "It is the finding of this Croquet Appellant Court in the action Mallet versus Wackers, Neanderthal Player Legality, that the Wackers' complaint is upheld. In the eyes of English law, Neanderthals are not humans and cannot play." The Reading side of the crowd erupted into joyous yells as the judge's ruling was run up on the screen. Aubrey opened his mouth, but I pulled him aside. "Don't waste your breath, Aubrey." "We can prepare an appeal in 7 minutes," said Mr. Runcorn, one of our lawyers. "I think we can find a non-human precedent in the Worcester Sauces versus Taunton Ciders Super Hoop semi-finals of 1963. Aubrey scratched his head and looked at me. "Thursday?" "A failed appeal could result in a two-hoop forfeit," I pointed out. "I say we get the lawyers working on it. If they think it's worth a try, we'll lodge an appeal at the end of the first third."
"But we're 5 players down, and we haven't even picked up our mallets."
"The game's not lost until it's lost, Aubrey. We've got a few tricks up our sleeve, too." I wasn't kidding. I had visited the lawyers' pavilion earlier, where they were performing background checks on every player on the opposing side. The Wackers' striker, George Rhino McNasty, had 14 unpaid parking violations, and our legal team successfully pleaded that this should be heard here and now. He was sentenced to an hour's community service, which effectively had him picking up litter in the car park until the end of the second third. Jam turned back to Mr. Runcorn. "Okay, prepare an appeal for the end of the first third. We'll start with what we've got." Even with our substitute brought on, we still had only 6 players to their full complement of 10. But it got worse. To play on a local side, you had to have been born in the town or lived there for at least 6 months before playing. Our substitute, John O. Swift, had lived here for only 5 months and 26 days when he began his career at the Mallets 3 years before. The Reading lawyers argued that he was playing illegally in his first match, a transgression that should have won him a life ban. Once again, the judges upheld the complaint, and, to another excited yell from the crowd, Swift walked dejectedly back to the dressing rooms. "Well," said O'Farthens, putting out his hand to Jam, "we'll accept you've conceded the match, okay?" "We're playing, O'Farthens. Even if Swindon were to lose 1,000 hoops, people will still stay." This was their finest... "I don't think so," interrupted the Wackers team lawyer with a triumphant grin. "You're now down to only 5 players. Under Rule 681G, subsection F/6, any team that fails to start the game with the minimum of 6 players forfeits the match." He pointed out the entry in Volume 7 of the World Croquet League rulebook. It was there all right, just under the rules governing the minimum raisin requirement in the buns served at the concession stand. Beaten. Beaten even before we'd picked up a mallet. Swindon could weather it, but the world could not. The revealment would be broken, and Cain and Goliath would carry on their perverse plans unmolested. "I'll announce it," said the umpire. "No," said Alf, clicking his fingers. "We do have a player we can field."
"Who?"
He pointed at me. "Thursday."
I was gobsmacked. I hadn't played for over 8 years.
"Objection," blurted out the Wackers lawyer. "Miss Next is not a native of Swindon." My inclusion would be of questionable value, but at least it meant we could play. "I was born at St. Septic's," I said slowly. "I'm Swindon enough for this team."
"Perhaps Swindon enough," said the lawyer, consulting a rule book hurriedly, "but not experienced enough."
According to Rule 23F, subsection G/9, you are ineligible to play international standard croquet since you have not played the minimum of 10 matches to county standard.
I thought for a moment.
Actually, I have.
It was true. I used to play for the Spec Ops Middlesex team when I was based in London. I was quite good, too, but nothing like these guys.
It is the decision of the Croquet Appellant Court, intoned the three judges, who wanted to see a good game the same as anyone, that Miss Next be allowed to represent her city in this match.
O'Farthen's face fell.
This is preposterous! What kind of stupid decision is that?
The judges looked at him sternly. It is the decision of this court, and we find you in contempt. The Whackers will forfeit one hoop.
O'Farthen's boiled with inner rage, held it within him, turned on his heel, and followed by his lawyers, strode to where his team was waiting.
Good one, laughed Aubrey. The whistle hasn't even gone, and we're winning.
He tried to sound full of enthusiasm, but it was difficult. We were fielding a 6-strong team, 5 1/4 if you count me, and still had an entire game to play.
We've got 10 minutes to the off. Thursday, get changed into Snake's spare set. He's about your size.
I dashed off to the changing rooms and dressed myself up in Snake's leg guards and shoulder pads. Widdershane helped me adjust the straps around my chest, and I grabbed a spare mallet before running back onto the field, fiddling with my helmet strap just as Aubrey was beginning his strategy talk.
In past matches, he said in a hushed tone, the Whackers have been known to test a weak side with a standard Bomparini opening tactic, a deflective feint towards mid-hoop left, but actually aiming for an undefended back-hoop right. The team whistled low, but we'll be ready for them. I want them to know we're playing an aggressive game. Instead of back-footing it, we'll go straight into a surprise roquet manoeuvre. Smudger, you're to lead with a sideways deflection to Biffo, who'll pass to Thursday.
Wait, put in Biffo. Thursday's here making up the numbers. She hasn't hit a ball in years.
This was true, but Jam had bigger plans.
Exactly. I want them to think Thursday is a dark horse, that we planned this late addition. With a bit of luck, they'll waste a good player marking her. Thursday, drive it towards their red ball, and Spike will intercept. It doesn't matter if you miss. I want them to be confused by our tactics. And Penelope, just frighten the other team.
Ugh,
grunted the wing woman. Okay, keep it tight. No more violence than is necessary. And keep an eye out for the Duchess. She's not averse to a bit of ankle swiping. We all tapped our fists together and made a harumph noise. I walked slowly to my place on the green, my heart beating with the pump of adrenaline.
You okay? It was Aubrey.
Sure.
Good. Let's play some croquet.